Okay, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing. December 22nd, 1980, Mr. Ray Bell. Okay, first of all, Mr. Bell, just kind of tell me what connections you had with Vinegar Hill, the community, the area.
Well, my connection with Vinegar Hill would have to go back to the time that I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
I was born not in Vinegar Hill, but one block where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was born upstairs on the top of this
room. Are you serious?
Yeah. In those days, mothers had children at home.
Right.
But Vinegar Hill proper started at 4th Street, mm-hmm. Northwest,
mm-hmm.
which is down the street here,
mm-hmm.
one block. And that, when I got married in 1955, my wife and I moved into a little house in the Vinegar Hill neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
which was right above Zion Union Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
That's the old Zion Union. There is a new Zion Union where Reverend Hales
mm-hmm.
is the pastor on Preston Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
But I lived two doors from the old Zion Union Church, which was 4th Street, and the address was 206 4th Street Northwest. Of course, that was all torn down, that area, that
mm-hmm.
whole
mm-hmm.
Vinegar Hill section. So my connection there was one as a resident.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, we did not have a neighborhood association
mm-hmm.
because the blacks and whites did not really get together in groups
mm-hmm.
to try to
mm-hmm.
politicize anything. We were more or less adversaries, the blacks versus
mm-hmm.
the white community.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be my connection.
Mm-hmm.
I was a resident of the
mm-hmm.
hill, and I was running from a lady who was named Nanny Cox Jackson, who
mm-hmm.
owned perhaps more property in the Vinegar Hill District than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
She was a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
She taught home economics at Jefferson School. And if anyone would like to do a study on Charlottesville, they would have to do it on Nanny Cox Jackson.
Yeah, another girl in the class interviewed her too.
Mm-hmm. Oh. No, they didn't interview her, they interviewed her granddaughter.
Oh.
Because Nanny Cox Jackson's been dead.
Oh, okay.
Nanny Cox died. Oh, gee.
Is her granddaughter named Cox?
No, her granddaughter's named Teresa
mm-hmm.
Jackson Walker,
mm-hmm.
who is the president of the Star Hill Neighborhood Association,
mm-hmm.
who lives right down on this street here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, her address is 206 6th Street, Northwest.
Oh.
And it was her grandmother to whom I went from.
Mm-hmm.
That was the connection.
Oh.
And Nanny Cox Jackson bought up a lot of real estate,
mm-hmm.
and she owned a lot of businesses,
mm-hmm.
buildings that people rent from her on Main Street,
mm-hmm.
which was the southern boundary of the Vinegar Hill District. I lived in what was called the west boundary of Vinegar Hill, which was 4th Street Northwest. So that would be my connection.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, who started this business, came to Charlottesville in 1917, and his first funeral home was located in Vinegar Hill because that's where all the black businesses were.
Mm-hmm.
And they more or less had been restricted to opening businesses within that Vinegar Hill district. He stayed there until 1925, and he moved not very far. He moved to this location,
mm-hmm.
6th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And we are approximately 2.5 blocks from Vinegar Hill. So he built this building, and it was built by a black contractor named Charlie Coase, who had his office on Vinegar
mm-hmm.
Hill.
Hmm.
So most of your businesses, most of your insurance offices, restaurants, the Masonic building, some churches were located in the Vinegar Hill District.
Mm-hmm.
And my father came to Charlottesville at the invitation of his first cousin, who was Dr. Jackson, who lives on the corner of 4th Street and Palmer Street. And Dr. Jackson was very instrumental in getting several professionals out of Petersburg to come here. He got a man named Dr. Chazelle, who was a medical doctor,
mm-hmm.
to come to Charlottesville. He got a man named Dr. Daphne, who was a pharmacist. So Chazelle came to Charlottesville, Dabney came, and Bell came, all Petersburg boys. Mm-hmm. They all grew up in Petersburg. Mm-hmm. So they were doing their black economic development way back then in the 80s, you see.
Mm-hmm. Huh. What type of... You were saying that it was mostly blacks were adversaries to whites at the time, and there wasn't really any neighborhood organization.
Well, you had, not only were there no neighborhood organizations, mm-hmm. per se, such as we have today, but we have integrated neighborhood associations, but we had no, really, we had no political power. Mm-hmm. We had no one represented on city council.
Mm-hmm.
You must remember, at this time, there were no black people elected to city council. Charles mm-hmm. Barber was the first black on city
mm-hmm.
council.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first black that was appointed to the school board here in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen until 1963. And we had had blacks to run for city council. Mm-hmm. We had a Dr. Bernard Coase who ran for the city council. And after Dr. Coase ran, he was unsuccessful. There was a fellow named George Hardy,
mm-hmm.
who was the president of NACP. And then there was Charles Johnson, who was mm-hmm. the local funeral director. Then we had Charlie Barber.
Mm-hmm.
So until Charlie Barber came along, we just had no voice mm-hmm. on city council. Now we had blacks helping to elect white candidates,
mm-hmm.
and we realized our political power, and that's how we were able to get Charlie
mm-hmm.
nominated. I made the nominating speech mm-hmm. along with Reverend Bond at a Democratic nominating convention for Charlie Barber.
Mm-hmm.
The whites didn't like it. But we were going, the black leadership said, well, okay, it's time we run some of our own people, and we're going to run them on a ticket with
mm-hmm.
The Democrats. So Francis Fife
mm-hmm.
and Charles Barber ran together
oh.
as the representatives of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for the first time, used their money, the money of the Democratic Party,
right.
to finance
mm-hmm.
Charlie's candidates. And he was
elected.
And in fact, when Charlie was elected to city council, blacks had the balance of power in terms of votes. And that was a political reality. The whites knew this.
Right.
Their candidate could not get on city council without black support.
Huh. How did the blacks get this balance of power? Did the just the voting?
Registration. The NACP.
Tell me about
the NACP. You see, that at the time, when I came back here from Boston in 53, we had a very small branch of NACP. And through the efforts of a fellow named Charles Fowler, who became president, and a man who still lives here, Eugene Williams, we were able to get something like 1,500 members for a local branch of NACP,
mm-hmm.
unheard of. In fact, we won the Ike Small Award
mm-hmm.
for the greatest percentage increase in the country for an NACP branch.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to New York with Eugene Williams to conduct a workshop on how we were able to get people to join, how we were able to organize.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
from that group, we were able to get people registered.
Mm-hmm.
Not only we designated certain precincts where black people live. We were the Lane High School precinct, the Fire House precinct, and the Venable School precinct were the predominantly areas where black folks lived.
Mm-hmm.
So we got out and knocked on doors and got people to register.
Hmm.
And got them out on the day of election.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a political reality that we could
mm-hmm.
we could kind of determine who would run.
Mm-hmm.
So we could say to them, we want to run a candidate,
right.
and we expect your support.
Mm-hmm.
You play ball with us, we play ball with you. So that's how Charlie got elected.
Mm-hmm.
Once he got on council, it became a kind of political reality to the white folks that
right.
these black folks mean business. We want some things.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we got very much,
mm-hmm.
but we did earn a voice
right.
in government.
Mm-hmm.
One voice isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
But Charlie got in, and
mm-hmm.
other Democratic candidates mm-hmm. wanted to win, mm-hmm. and they supported the mm-hmm. supported the black leadership. Yeah. Then we had a little change in the politics of the city government. We got mm-hmm. Cole Hendricks in. Mm-hmm. There had been a man named Jim Mowing who was city manager for many years, and Mr. Bowen was a very conservative type of administrator. And with Cole Hendricks coming in, we found that we got a little more cooperation from city government. We got more blacks hired. Mm-hmm. We were interested in getting blacks hired. We still haven't got blacks hired in the decision-making slots that we still want. We have Mr. Garrett, who's an assistant city attorney, but Billy Mitchell was an assistant to the city manager. He was not an assistant city mm-hmm. manager. We still want this type thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've had Billy Cooper, who became a city planner in the planning department mm-hmm. with Mr. Hooja. Mm-hmm. Billy Cooper is a product of Richmond mm-hmm. public schools. Mm-hmm. He was born there and came to the university. Mm-hmm. Got both his undergraduate degree and graduate degree. Mm-hmm. And as a member of Star Hill Neighborhood Association, when they were looking for someone to head up that project, the Star Hill Neighborhood Association influenced the city government and told him that we should have a black person mm-hmm. heading that project mm-hmm. because it was the Star Hill Neighborhood wow. Association, made up of mostly black people, mm-hmm. that initiated the idea of doing some things in the inner city, in this part of the city. And what? The city got an inner city grant, you see, mm-hmm. monies to do some things in mm-hmm. Star Hill.
But what exactly was the Star Hill project? And when did it start?
Well, I started, I think, originally the grant, the proposal was made some 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I think it took a year or so to get the money. And it was a grant for the renovation of dilapidated housing mm-hmm. to do some things cosmetically in terms of painting houses. They gave free paint. Mm-hmm. to the businesses and residential mm-hmm. Homeowners to paint. Mm-hmm. They put sidewalks down, drainage, lighting, planted trees on West Main Street. Along the West Main Street corridor, right above the Renegade Hill section, you had old mm-hmm. stores closing down and yeah. buildings were being, the Inn store is an example, mm-hmm. which is still there,
right.
needs renovation. Mm-hmm. So. The city made a proposal for the grant, and they got, I think, something like $2 million for this project.
Right.
Now, the only failure we've had with that, because a part of the grant was for economic development, minority economic development,
mm-hmm.
and I have been very active in that Star Hill thing, and we have not been successful in getting black businesses into Star Hill. Because of the money problem. When you start a business, the bank will tell you, yeah, we're willing to help you, but you've got to come up with some money of your own.
Hmm.
And we have not been able to get blacks hmm. to be able to come in who have had the wherewithal to start a business.
Hmm.
And I think, personally, that the banks are going to have to take some risks
mm-hmm.
in terms of letting people who have the experience and the know-how to come in. And get a loan package without any collateral. They'll have collateral of experience
mm-hmm.
and a track record of doing something successful in other things. And the bank can say, well, look, we'll let you have your money. You pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
Because until we do that, we're not going to get any black businesses in. And mm-hmm. banks, of course, have to answer to their shareholders mm-hmm. and they're reluctant to make loans to people, white or black, mm-hmm. without collateral. And that's mm-hmm. understandable. But in that it's failed so far,
mm-hmm.
it is my opinion, mm-hmm. after seeing it the process, that we've got to do more in getting black mm-hmm. businesses started.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some blacks who come into the who've applied for some jobs, some business loans, who I think, and I'm very confident that they could do it,
mm-hmm.
but they need the capital.
Hmm.
And that is the one failure that I've been, in this style. And of course, now Mr. Cooper, Bill Cooper, unfortunately, has resigned from his job, and he took a similar job because of money. The salary was quite a boost. So he went to Alexandria, Virginia, to be a city planner up there, and he's going to do more or less the same thing that he did here in Stock Hill, only he has $11 million.
Oh.
And most of it is money that the city of Alexandria raised through the sale of municipal bonds. So he's not dealing with the federal bureaucracy.
Right.
So he's going to be able to do a little more in terms of the renovation there than he did here. And I'm very happy that he found a job. I just hope they would have been able to keep him here by offering him more money. But they claim they didn't have the money.
So the Stock Hill grant was a federal grant?
Yes.
The city of Charlottesville isn't willing to give any money for the project?
Well, no, they're not. They're not in the position right now because of some, revenue problems to give money for this type project. Cities don't traditionally do that because you're talking about taking local taxes and doing things that folks don't want that done. They have other priorities that the day will come over they're going to have to, and they're doing it in terms of municipal bonds, but I don't know what you call the municipal bonds, but they are being able to work with some local banks and selling bonds that have low interest, but the city suffers no liability under that process. They just give it a municipal type. They're able to do it tax free. You see.
A lot of
what's
going on.
Dean Harris has been very helpful and very instrumental. He has served as consultant from the beginning to the Stock Hill Neighborhood Association. And he has been able to sit in on the conferences. We meet with Mr. Hooger and his staff once every month concerning Stock Hill. Stock Hill was a project that grew out of the local citizens' wishes and desires. And one of the things that we were able to support the city in designing the Stock Hill project, we did not want any blacks or anyone who lived in Stock Hill, white or black, but especially blacks, to be disrupted from their homes, because we have some retired people here in this community, many of whom had been displaced in the Bentley Hills section. So we were able to get a memorandum of agreement with the council that no property would be taken through eminent domain. And these people who wanted to stay here will be able to stay. And that has been a very good.
Also, in that way, it was more successful than Vinegar Hill.
Yes.
And people tried to stop there.
Right, because in that day, you weren't stopping that. You know, we refer to that as urban removal rather than urban renewal. The removal of black businesses and homeowners.
Blacks just didn't have enough power then to stop the Vinegar Hill?
Yes, well, true. And then the local government was insensitive to the wishes and desires of people. You have to cut that off somewhere.
Okay, I think I go back to, I guess, the 50s and 60s. What was going on in Charlottesville at the time of demonstrations, protest marches, the civil rights era?
Yeah, well, of course, now Charlottesville kind of fought his battle on that through the, we were, as you may or may not know, the Byrd Machine in Richmond took a stance on the desegregation issue when the courts, you know, struck down school segregation. the state government took a stance of massive resistance, that they would resist this, and they waved the banner of states' rights. And I think Lindsey Allman was the governor at the time. And there was a case in court case in Charlottesville where it was called Allen versus the Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on through the various state and federal courts, and it ended up over in Harrisonburg with Judge Paul.
Judge Paul.
And that's a very interesting era of discussion because we had Spotwood Robinson, Oliver Hill, Mr. Tucker, Sam Tucker came on later. But we took that case on, Allen versus, and it was named after the first black child. His name was Ernest Allen. Who now coaches basketball. He's an assistant coach at Virginia Tech. He tried to get Rap Sampson.
Oh, really?
Ernestly recruited Rap Sampson. But mm-hmm. Ernest was a young kid at the time, and his parents hated him. So it was Allen versus Board of Education. So as a consequence of massive resistance, the Charlottesville schools were closed. They closed mm-hmm. down all the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the black kids went to private homes to be tutored.
Mm-hmm.
My sister, who was a teacher in public school, was one of the teachers that taught.
Oh.
I remember Ronald and the twin boys, Ronald and another, Robert and Ronald.
Still from Woodfall?
Yeah, they used to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And upstairs and to
really?
Olivia Ferguson, the daughter of George
Mr.
Ferguson,
uh-huh.
who was the president of NACP mm-hmm. at the time, insisted on going to Wayne High School.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't allow her to go, and she ended up going to a little tutoring class up at the school board office on 14th Street, right mm-hmm. next to Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this early of massive resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Kids out of school, and then of course Judge Paul ruling that schools would be desegregated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you had the mayor of Charlottesville named Judge E. Mickey, who was the father of Tom Mickey, just mm-hmm. elected to the office mm-hmm. of the Senate in Richmond. His father was mayor. He had been a lawyer and a military governor overseas in Italy during the occupation. And he was mayor, and he issued a proclamation saying that anyone that would interfere with the orderly process of desegregation mm-hmm. would be arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he meant it. He meant anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that was a warning to the white citizens.
Right.
So the first day of school, that was a big deal. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, the kids said, well, the blacks are there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did the white kids go to school?
Oh, yeah. Some parents kept their children, white parents kept their children out.
Mm-hmm.
But they went, and there were, of course, problems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, Charlottesville was one of the first schools in the state of Virginia to reopen.
Oh,
this new,
after the
massive resistance. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And that's an interesting part of history.
Mm-hmm.
And Olivia got her diploma from high school, not from the, not in the commencement exercise,
mm-hmm.
but just from that local office.
That's right.
You see.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. I haven't been on the school board. Was asked before a civil rights commission one time, why was Charlottesville able to desegregate its schools so much faster than other places
mm-hmm.
like Prince Edward's County?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer to that commission was that it was because of Allen versus Wilkinson. We went through the courts.
Oh.
And mm-hmm. I think the NACP mm-hmm. selected Charlottesville as one of the test cases. Just being at that whole effort.
Mm-hmm. And that got it through the courts fast. They got lawyers and everything.
Yes, and they concentrated on Charlottesville.
Right.
And Judge Paul issued an order that the schools would be considered segregated, and they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, that meant the phasing out of Burley High School, which was a joint consolidated school of county and city blacks. Only black.
Oh.
See, Burley High School was a black high school.
Oh.
And you had black kids coming from the county being bused, and the Charlottesville school kids going to Burley. They walked to school, and county kids were bused there.
Mm-hmm.
So that school was phased out after the desegregation order. Mm-hmm. And the black kids went slain, and the county black kids had to go to Albemarle.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that process of evolution in terms of civil rights. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other front, we, of course, the NAACP was very active in that case of schools, but we were hitting employees at the time. We had an interracial commission here headed by a man named Henry Hayden, who was president of a local bank.
Mm-hmm.
And we served on that commission along with three or four other black people. And our aim then was to be able to get desegregated facilities, restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to Holiday Inn North. I remember going there with Mr. Williams, and I walked in, and the waiter said to me, or the manager, you know, we don't serve blacks here, but you can eat here, because not knowing that I was a black, looking at me, you wouldn't know. So I told him we would be, so we were, so we ended up sitting in at that Holiday Inn for a couple of days, maybe desegregated.
Hmm.
And several other places. There was a little rudeness up in a place called Buddy's. He closed his restaurant, which is now on Emma Street right across from the Cavalier Motel. That was where you see the AA. Touring, whatever that AA thing is. That was Buddy's restaurant.
Oh.
And we went up there, and a man by the name of Henry Johnson, the Reverend Henry, bought it. H. Ford Johnson was the minister of his own union. And it was at that location that Reverend Johnson was jumped on by some huge man, some white guy, who attacked him to try to break up the marching, the protest march.
Oh.
And we didn't let that deter us. Mm-hmm. We kept coming back. Mm-hmm. And that he closed down rather than to open his place at that time. So that was the only one I remember where there was physical violence. But on the whole, it was a bitter pill, and they were reluctant to swallow it. Things happened.
Mm-hmm. What, did they finally just give in and say okay?
Yeah, because we were going to sue them. They knew that they were going to be for an example, and we had some very well-meaning white people who went to some of the restaurants up on the corner and talked with the owners and said, well, why don't you open this place up to your black students at the university? And they went along with the project.
Mm-hmm.
They went along with it. Yeah. It gradually worked out that we weren't going to give them any disease back associated with it. But they were, it was tradition, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they after the schools were desegregated, and we've been getting to the NAACP that deserves a great deal of credit for that.
Really?
That was the one, that organization was the one mechanism that made things happen locally. Of course, you have the civil rights marches going on in Selma, Alabama, and all the kind of things. Yes, things were happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another phase where we attacked the segregated housing in Charlottesville. We wanted the fair housing rule. Mm-hmm. And we would go out on Sundays and go to white developments such as the one off of Cherry Avenue. There's one Johnson Village. Johnson Village. I remember going over there. And they didn't want to show us any housing.
Oh.
The Red and Bun was very active in the housing.
Oh. Red and Bun's still here, right?
Yes. He is with the First Baptist mm-hmm. Church, and he just, he's stepping down this year. He's been
really?
There 36 years. He
oh.
was the founder of the local NACP branch here.
He was?
Yeah.
Oh, he'd be good to talk to.
Right.
And I'll stop by there on my walk back.
And you should talk with his wife, because she was the first, Mrs. Bond was the first black in charge of the health department, the visiting nurses.
Oh, really?
She was a pioneer in that.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them would be very good sources. They're in the phone book, but they live in the county. Go away inside, so you would have some trouble. That's
oh,
the,
yeah.
He would
yeah.
come into the church and yeah. probably talk to
uh-huh,
you.
Uh-huh.
But he, both Mrs. Bond and Reverend would be good.
He'd be really good. Maybe I could get... Okay.
So you have developments moving... toward the, you know, desegregation in terms of housing,
mm-hmm.
school, employment, public facilities. And there's an interesting chapter on the University of Virginia Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We had, at one time, all the blacks were in the basement of an old ward at the hospital. And we bought Spotwood Robinson and Oliver Hill here, and we talked about it. And Mr. Randolph White mm-hmm. is probably the top black there who did all the hiring of black people, black orderlies. And Randolph White is very active. He's the man who's the editor and publisher of the Charlottesville Outlaw Tribune. And he would talk with you about the phase where they wrote the record hospitals and all the blacks would strike if they didn't move
mm-hmm,
the patients.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, with the threat of a lawsuit, because it was a government facility, a state
mm-hmm,
facility,
yeah.
They were able to desegregate that black ward in one day. They moved all the black patients up to the wards.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem they ran into, although the administrators and the policy makers made policy, we ran into the problem of people who were ward nurses who wanted to maintain segregation. They would put blacks
mm-hmm.
with blacks. They
mm-hmm.
wouldn't integrate the ward.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go back and
mm-hmm.
threaten
mm-hmm.
them again with a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
So the administration sent out a memorandum to the effect that if you block this, you lose it, you'd be fired.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a problem there,
mm-hmm.
getting the so-called blind folks, blind staff, to go along with what
mm-hmm.
their superiors
mm-hmm.
wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to fight that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when one of my children, my second son was born there, they were saying that they had no room on Barringer. So my wife, who wanted a room and could afford a private room, so they wanted to stick her in some little nondescript room without a bath, so without a bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, knowing blacks that worked there, I was able to make one phone call, and I found out what room was vacant on Barringer.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the director and told the man named John Stacy, who was the director, if he didn't give her that room,
mm-hmm.
I would sue her. Within an hour, she was in her own. So you have to do all those kind of things.
Right.
You threaten people
mm-hmm.
with suits, and,
mm-hmm.
and it was a difficult thing to try to break down.
Right. Were any of the suits actually followed through if they didn't?
Well, they fell in line. We didn't have
always?
To. But oh yes,
oh.
We were willing to. Oh yeah, we were going to see them, and they knew it.
Mm-hmm.
We meant
mm-hmm.
business
mm-hmm.
because where the blacks were, there were pipes dripping, rats.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of, I remember going through the hall, they would actually have people out in the corridors,
mm-hmm.
blacks, because they wouldn't put him upstairs in empty rooms. This is before the desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
That's this type of thing can be repeated all over the site.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and you're paying your money. They're charging you as much as they charge everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk through that hall downstairs there in the basement, and Black would be in it, lined up in bed, or third, sick people, in that type of environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know the history of the University of Virginia. You had a man named Swanson who applied for law school. He was admitted. He didn't finish, but he won admission to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And Booker Reeves got into school education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Booker was the first Black to be graduated from the university. But they you know, went really slowly, screaming in Panama, shouting and screaming before they were here. But as the politics, the reality of politics, and you were able to, these politicians would come to the Black community and you would tell them, you'd give them some demands, you know, if you want to be in office, you're going to have to do some things.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to affect change through the political process.
Mm-hmm.
And we still need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't happened yet, because you only have to look in the city hall in terms of Blacks. You don't even have any Blacks in either county or city government can do any, can make some decisions.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask what happened after, I guess after the 60s and the protesting, what happened to the membership of the NAACP? What happened?
Well, I'll tell you what happened with it, like it happened all over the country.
Right.
Apathy set in. And you have people saying, oh boy, you know, we've made it.
Yeah.
But the truth is, we ain't made it.
Yeah.
We're far from. And it just breaks your heart to see, go to NAACP meetings now, you don't even have enough numbers sometimes to have a quorum. And I, along with some others, have been out there 30 years with NAACP, and we don't have young people coming along.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people who have enjoyed the fruits of other people laboring to bring about change are so damn comfortable in their jobs, they don't even come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking of school teachers in particular, who make pretty good money, and yet you have to drag them to get them to join the NAACP. I think it's worse now in terms of, there's so much more we've got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we can get into the economic mainstream, well, we can say, you know, it's nice to be able to stay in Hilton Chains and all this business, but it takes money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you still, Black's not making the kind of money whites in this community.
Hmm.
And I frankly am really disturbed about the apathy of Blacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You still have many Blacks leaving Charlottesville after graduation, going to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Involved on other places where they should stay here and try to do things here.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that we'll see today, and there has been a trend of some Blacks returning to the site, but I don't know if many coming back to Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what you were talking about, the political process, one interesting thing that has just happened that will ensure Black representation on city council, because after Charlie Barber, there was a period there where we had no Blacks on city council. With this new concern that the NAACP made affecting the ward system, where you have ward representation and council members elected at large, that would ensure representation, because you'll have Blacks coming out of these predominantly Black precincts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very important that we adopt that.
Mm-hmm.
It's before City Council, it has to go into the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to get our representatives in Richmond to change this law so that we could go to at large, kind of a mixed system, the ward and an at large system of electing city council. That way we'll always have representation. And that is what the NACP concern was from the very beginning. I have been active recently, last year, serving as chairman of the NACP Education Committee about the competency test. When the blacks first took that at the high school, we had a very large percentage of blacks failing that test. So that has been a kind of a, we were in a meeting the other day with Dr. Ellen and Mrs. Lugo, who serves on the school board, and we were going over a first draft of a report that was done by Dr. Frederick Rogers, who happens to be black, who made an evaluation or a measurement of various tests in the school system in Charlottesville. And this report, in this first draft, indicates that blacks are not achieving at the levels of non-blacks. The report did not tell me or the committee anything new that we didn't know, because we know that, and unfortunately in that report, Dr. Rogers was not given the mandate nor the authority to go in to the classroom and make an evaluation, because we think what is happening in the classroom is the reason for low achievement on the part of blacks, because black kids come into the school system on a pretty equal level with whites, and within 4 years there is a trend in underachievement on the part of those blacks. There's a reason for that.
Right.
And I believe the chemistry that takes place between the teacher and the student is the key cause of it. So until we can measure instruction, we are not going to be able to document some of the things we think are happening. And we were told recently, and in reference to this meeting, that the blacks are doing so much better, and that there are only three students that haven't passed the Thompson test, and it's coming up in senior class. But I suspect that the remediation has been toward the test, teaching the kids to take the test, which doesn't really do it. It's got to happen down from K through 4.
That's right.
And then through the middle school, they need to be tested every year and find out where the problem is in elementary school. Otherwise, these kids who are not achieving are going to be wiped out in their early education. And they'll never be able to catch up in high school. They're, for all intent and purpose, they'll be almost illiterate to begin with, back from what they weren't getting. So why do we wait until they get to senior high school and tell them, well, look, we're going to test you. And if you don't pass, you don't get a diploma. And what you're doing is certifying people. And that's all some of these employers want to know. This will be another excuse to discriminate against black employment. Well, you didn't pass the test. You don't have a diploma.
Right.
So we can't hire you. See, this is kind of a catch-22. So the NACP is very concerned about this. And we maintain there needs to be staff development. And we were told that there's been someone brought on recently who's going to do that very thing. So they told us in the meeting that there has been an effort. They brought someone in from North Carolina who's doing staff development, and I hope that that will be a help. But kids are going to have to be taught from the time we're in school. And the atmosphere is going to have to be, the environment is going to have to be one of learning. And you can't do it in class where the people teacher ratio is too large.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to help kids who need help.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm very encouraged to hear that Dr. Davis, John Davis, who's the new commissioner of education, is thinking along the same lines,
mm-hmm.
that you've got to test these kids at early level.
Right.
And they don't let them proceed until they
mm-hmm.
reach that level of achievement that gives them a green light to go ahead.
Right. I remember when I was going to school, junior high school, they had to have a certain number of kids graduated,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Right.
And they couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how they got graduated,
right.
but
right.
the teachers wanted their salaries.
Yeah, that's the problem. So I think, I'm actually a school teacher, and I
mm-hmm.
know, listening to her tell me, because she started off teaching in the elementary school, and she was telling me there is a great deal that the teacher can do in helping a kid.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't learn one way, you get to devise a
yeah.
method, a way of reaching that child. And kids can be reached.
Uh-huh.
Children, and
I think so too.
You've got to expect that they can learn.
Uh-huh.
If they are in an environment that does not show them concerned and loved and
puts them into some type
yes.
of stereotype.
Yeah, and little boy raises his hand 5 or 6 times and he's never called
right.
by. Because I don't want that black kid answering.
Mm-hmm.
You got a problem with that
mm-hmm.
teacher.
Mm-hmm.
They have no business teaching.